you to eat healthier. Posting your 3 daily intentions in a visible place will remind you to work on what's actually important throughout the day. Keeping a TV in your bedroom will remind you that a world of news and entertainment can be accessed with just the press of a button, an object of attention much more enticing than sleep. Facing your couches and chairs toward the TV instead of toward one another will have a similarly tempting effect. Leaving your phone on the table when eating breakfast will introduce an environmental cue that reminds you a world of distraction awaits. This is the irony of using our smartphone when we're socializing with another person. We largely use the device to cultivate relationships with other people, but no smartphone experience will ever be as meaningful as a face-to-face encounter. External environmental cues can affect us in remarkable ways. One study observed coffee shop patrons conversing with one another and discovered that those who kept their phone in front of them checked it every 3 to 5 minutes, quote, regardless of whether it rang or buzzed, end quote. As the study put it, quote, even when they are not in an active use or buzzing, beeping, ringing, or flashing, our phones are representative of our wider social network and a portal to an immense compendium of information, end quote. Another study concluded, somewhat sadly, that the, quote, mere presence of a cell phone placed innocuously in the visual field of participants was found to interfere with closeness, connection, and relationship quality, end quote. So often, these cues in our environment pull us away from what we intend to accomplish, and on a personal level, make our experiences less meaningful. Environmental cues don't actively interrupt us, like notifications, but they can do just as much harm to our productivity and personal life. This is especially the case when we look around for a novel distraction from a complex task. Our working environment should hold as few of these distracting cues as possible. When we keep our phone, tablet, and television in another room, we are derailed less often, become accustomed to working in a less stimulating environment, and ensure the environment around us is not more attractive than what we intend to focus on. By eliminating the novel cues in our working environment, we give ourselves the ability to focus for much longer. It's worth becoming deliberate about the cues you allow into your environment and questioning how they might affect your productivity. Environmental cues are so powerful, even the cleanliness of your office has an impact on your productivity. Research shows that neat environments are more conducive to focus, and messy environments are more conducive to creativity. For this reason, if you want all the participants in a meeting to focus on a project, invite them into a clean conference room with few distractions. If you want to break with convention, affect change, or have a more creative brainstorming session, hold the meeting in a messier environment. If there isn't a cluttered meeting room at the office, mix things up and have a meeting off-site, such as outdoors in nature, where everyone is exposed to new insight triggers. Though be wary of walking meetings. Walking, including when you work, such as on a treadmill desk, has been shown to decrease cognitive performance. Performance increases after a walk, however. Since observing how much time and attention I waste on devices like my tablet and smartphone, I've rarely kept them in my external environment unless they serve a purpose. My tablet is currently in another room, and my phone is on a table across my office, well out of reach. One study found that when a distraction is about 20 seconds away from us, when it takes 20 seconds to retrieve a bag of chips from the basement, unlock a drawer to get our cell phone, or restart our computer to access distracting websites, it provides enough of a temporal distance for us to not fall victim to these distractions, and we're better able to control our impulses. It's in this space between impulse and action that we regain control over our attention, and introducing a 20-second delay gives us the awareness to resist impulses we naturally have. There's a lot of stuff in front of me as I write this. A meditation cushion, a pair of adjustable dumbbells, several plants, a cup of matcha tea, pictures of family, a fidget cube, a whiteboard, and my turtle, Edward, basking on her rock. These things won't derail my attention for long. They simply aren't that complex, so unlike a smartphone, they can't completely hijack my attention. If I do get distracted by them, it's much easier to notice that my mind has wandered, and it's easier for me to get back on track. Novel objects of attention threaten to invade your attentional space and prevent you from focusing completely on any one thing. To modify your environment to be more conducive to working or living, you should eliminate objects of attention that will potentially derail your focus. Doing this is actually pretty simple. 1. Take stock of the distractions around you. This is especially important in the place where you focus on your most complex work. Make a list of all potential distractions, everything from the tablet you keep by your desk to a coworker sharing your cubicle. Then consider, which of these do you find more attractive than your work? 2. Distance yourself. Just as with distractions, it's not possible to tame all environmental cues in advance, but you can control most. Make a plan to remove attractive objects of attention from your environment so you're not tempted by them. 3. Introduce more productive cues into your environment. Not all environmental cues are bad, and no one wants to work in a sterile environment. Plants, for example, have been shown to have a calming effect. We evolved to feel good in nature, not in cubicles. Hanging a whiteboard in your environment may prompt you to brainstorm your thoughts and is a useful place to write your 3 daily intentions. Lining up your favorite books on an office shelf might remind you of ideas as you work. Keeping a fidget cube by your side is a cue to occasionally take a break, daydream, and consider new ideas. Having a book on your nightstand instead of your phone will encourage you to read more. Storing your fruit in a bowl on the table instead of your refrigerator will prompt you to eat healthier. The cleanliness of your environment is also important. Make sure you tidy your space when you're done with it. Coming home to a mess of dishes in the sink and random objects strewn all over the floor will instantly stress you out, reminding you of all the things you still have to do. The same applies when you finish working for the day. Tidy the papers on your desk, close the windows on your computer, sort files on your desktop, and act on and archive each email you received that day. When you sit down at your desk the next morning, you'll be able to focus immediately on your intentions instead of becoming stressed about the previous day's progress. Decluttering your digital environment is just as important as decluttering your physical one. As you've probably found, environmental cues can also help our future selves. After I set my 3 overarching intentions for the following day at the end of the day prior, I write them on my whiteboard so they're what I see the first thing in the morning. If I need to remember to bring a few documents to a meeting, I'll put them by the door so I see them as I leave. Side note, if you ask people what places they're most productive, few will answer the office. In fact, most people will name any place but the office, including their favorite coffee shop, an airport, the train, or their home office. The reason for this, I'd argue, is that these environments contain fewer cues for all we have to get done. We don't overhear coworkers chatting about the projects we're working on. We don't walk by the meeting rooms where we regularly share progress reports. Mixing up where we work often lets us focus on what we intend to accomplish without distracting cues. Music. There are an awful lot of factors in the environment that affect focus. Even office temperature influences productivity to some degree. One study found that 70 to 72 degrees Fahrenheit, 21 to 22 degrees Celsius, is the ideal temperature for productivity. Lower temperatures increase the number of errors we make and how often we call in sick, and higher temperatures above 86 degrees Fahrenheit, 30 degrees Celsius, decrease our productivity by about 10%. We're all wired differently, of course, so your mileage may vary. Before getting to how your internal, mental environment influences your productivity, I want to zero in on one more external factor, It may be something you work with already. Music. While researching hyperfocus, I interviewed one of the most renowned musicians of our time. One who has sold more music than Prince, Britney Spears, Justin Bieber, or Bob Dylan. The man has almost single-handedly crafted the soundtrack to countless childhoods, and his videos easily attract millions of YouTube views. However, while you may recognize his music, you likely won't know Jerry Martin's name. Jerry composed the music scores for video games such as The Sims and SimCity, games that have collectively sold well over 100 million copies worldwide. He's also created soundtracks for Apple, General Motors, and NBA commercials. Jerry's music is the perfect place to start when looking at how music influences productivity, as he has created some of the most productive soundtracks in existence. Research suggests that the most productive music has two main attributes. It sounds familiar. Because of this, music that is productive for you may differ from your coworker's choices. And it's relatively simple. Jerry's music hits both of these notes. It sounds comfortably familiar, since it's heavily influenced by famous composers such as George Gershwin. It contains no words to distract you, and it's simple. As Martin told me, quote, "When you put too much structure in music, you tend to focus on it. The best kind of music exists in the background. There's really not much going on when you listen closely. The music is linear, changing without you knowing it, and is supporting your work in the game." End quote. For my own part, I love writing to songs on repeat and have been listening to the same depressing Ed Sheeran tune for the last hour. However, research also suggests that the most productive music is relative. Music occupies at least some portion of attentional space, but it occupies less when it's familiar, simple, and also relatively quiet. As a result, music is no competition for a quiet environment when it comes to focus, but of course, music never exists in isolation. If you're working in a busy coffee shop, music may help obscure the conversations around you, which are much more complex and distracting than a simple and familiar melody. If a loud coworker in the adjacent cubicle is on a telephone call, it's much more productive to throw in some noise-canceling headphones and listen to music. A study found that overhearing one side of a phone conversation is significantly more distracting than overhearing a regular dyadic conversation. So your brain works overtime to fill in the missing side of the half a log, so the conversation occupies more of your attentional space. A footnote on this. Secondhand distraction is a real phenomenon. Another experiment found that students who focused on a lecture were likely to score significantly worse if they could see a classmate multitasking on a laptop in front of them. These distracted students averaged 56% on a follow-up test, while those who weren't distracted scored 73%. That can be the equivalent of going from a D to a B grade. For this reason, some researchers advocate developing an attention-aware classroom in which students can be mindful of the cost of distractions. On the flip side, excessive classroom computer use can also be symptomatic of a larger problem, like that the lecture is boring and students aren't engaged. Back to music, though. The quiet serenity offered by music on noise-canceling headphones on a loud flight is much less distracting than the roar of the plane's engine. While I'm at a coffee shop and they inexplicably switch the soundtrack to talk radio, I'll listen to music. Your own experience with how music affects your productivity will vary depending on the nature of your work, your working environment, and even your personality. Music impairs the performance of introverts more than extroverts, for example. However, generally speaking, if you're looking to focus, keep the music you listen to simple and familiar. Clearing your mind. Of course, not all distractions are external, as we also keep a lot of distracting stuff in our heads. When writing a report, we remember we had a meeting that started 10 minutes ago. When we arrive home from work, we realize we forgot to stop to pick up bread. Clearing our head of these open loops is critical so they don't distract us in the moment as we're trying to focus. It's impossible to write about focus and productivity without citing David Allen's work. Allen is the author of Getting Things Done, a book with a simple premise that our brain is for having ideas, not for holding them. An empty brain is a productive brain, and the more stuff we get out of our heads, the more clearly we think. You're already familiar with this idea if you keep a calendar. You'd never be able to think clearly if you tried to keep track of all of your appointments and meetings in your head. You'd forever need to devote some portion of your attentional space to upcoming events, and this would be extraordinarily stressful. Keeping a to-do list has a similar effect. Each task you get out of your head and onto the list is a task that won't pester you as you're working on something else. You'll be able to think more clearly, and you'll experience less guilt about what you're working on as a result. Something remarkable happens when you externalize tasks and commitments. You work with almost no guilt, worry, or doubt. You experience guilt when you feel tension about your past, worry when you feel tension about your future, and doubt and stress when you feel tension about the present moment. These feelings evaporate when you set intentions and make a rough plan for how you'll complete your important tasks. You'll think more clearly, too. Externalizing what's on your mind means tasks and commitments won't pop into your attentional space as you're working. Maintaining a calendar or a to-do list turns internal distractions into external cues. You no longer need to keep in mind that you have a meeting. Your calendar app will do that for you. You don't need to remember to work on what's important. The task list on your desk acts as a cue to remind you of what you need to get done, especially when you keep your most important daily intentions at the top. This concept extends far beyond your tasks and appointments. Keeping a distractions list as you focus will remove distractions from your head so you can refocus more quickly and deal with them later on, as we discussed in chapter 5. If you're a worrier, create a list of everything weighing on your mind while scheduling a time to consider the validity of each of the entries. Capturing ideas that come to you as you let your mind rest and wander will mean you can make use of them later. Regularly reviewing a list of everything you're waiting for, one that records the important emails, letters, packages, and phone calls you're expecting, will get these things off your mind, too. Some people can get by with the bare minimum, keeping a to-do list and a calendar, and find additional lists cumbersome. Others find that they think most clearly when they capture every little thing weighing on their minds. I personally fall somewhere in between. Feel out your own threshold. Start with setting a few intentions every day and keep a to-do list and a calendar. Unresolved mental loops can tug at your attention throughout the day, especially when you're immersed in your most important work. Begin closing these open loops so you can focus and hyperfocus more easily on your work. Continuously capture unresolved commitments and ideas as they come up, and get into a habit of revisiting them at a set time later. This will free up a lot of attentional space to spend on better things. Working with purpose. Here is a fundamental truth about focus. Your brain will invariably resist more complex tasks, especially when you're first starting them. And when it does, you'll look around for more novel and stimulating things to do instead. When you clear your working environment of interruptions, distractions, and cues that will tempt you away from what you intend to accomplish in the moment, you'll stay on track. This chapter was long for a simple reason. There's a lot of brush you need to clear before you can hyperfocus. Recall the three measures we can use to measure the quality of our attention. How much time we spend working with intention, how long we're able to focus on one task, and how long our mind wanders before we catch it doing so. All three measures are supported by the tactics in this chapter. Creating a distraction-free mode lets you carve out time to spend intentionally, while eliminating the more attractive objects of attention that would ordinarily derail your focus. Working with fewer distractions in general lets you eliminate novel objects of attention throughout the day and reclaim more of your attention for what's important. Utilizing both of these working modes helps you train your brain to wander less and focus longer. Simplifying your working and living environments eliminates a slew of tempting distractions. Clearing your head of distracting open loops lets you work more clearly and frees up even more attentional space for your most important tasks. One final benefit of eliminating distractions in advance is gaining the freedom to work at a slower, more purposeful pace. One study, for example, found that when we text while reading something, it can take us anywhere from 22% to 59% longer to read the same passage. It doesn't matter if you work at a slower, more deliberate pace, if you're continuously working in the right direction. What you lose in speed, you make up for in intentionality. Carving out more attentional space for what you're doing also enables you to work with greater awareness of what distractions you're resisting, how you feel about your work, how much energy you have, and whether you need to recharge. In addition, you will actually notice temptations and impulses that arise, so you'll fall victim to them less often in the future. So far, we've covered the four stages of hyperfocus: choosing an object of attention, eliminating distractions, focusing on a task, and getting back on track. Now, let's talk about how you can make a habit out of setting the stage for this super productive state of mind by increasing the size of your attentional space and overcoming your resistance to hyperfocus. Chapter 5: Making Hyperfocus a Habit. What makes our minds wander? There is a wealth of research that examines why our mind wanders at the exact same time we're trying to focus. It does so significantly more when we're feeling stressed or bored, we're working in a chaotic environment, we're dealing with and thinking about a large number of personal concerns, we're questioning whether we're working on the most productive or meaningful task, or we have unused attentional space. The more we have, the more prone we are to mind-wandering episodes. Conveniently, we've already discussed these factors. Feeling stressed or bored. We experience stress when the demands of a situation exceed our ability to cope with them. By preventing attentional space overload, we ensure we have the resources needed to cope with such conditions. Working in a chaotic environment. I define boredom as the restlessness we feel as we transition from a state of high stimulation to a lower one. In becoming accustomed to experiencing less stimulation over time, by enabling our distraction-free mode whenever we hyperfocus, and by working with fewer distractions in general, we face this stimulation gap less often, experience boredom less frequently, and make our environment less chaotic by default. Thinking about personal concerns. Capturing our mind's open loops through a task list, a waiting for list, or even a worry list prevents unresolved items from weighing on our mind as we try to focus. This helps us deal better with chaotic environments and set aside personal concerns. Switching tasks less frequently also helps us think more clearly. We experience less attentional residue, which can take a toll on our limited attentional space. Questioning whether we're working on the best thing. Working with intention is the best way to experience fewer feelings of doubt about what we should or could be doing in any one moment. These feelings lead our minds to wander from what we're trying to focus on. Amount of unused attentional space. Deploying hyperfocus to work on our most complex tasks will consume more attentional space by default, which will, in turn, prevent our mind from wandering. The smaller the object of attention, the more likely mental wandering will occur. The tactics in this book work for a few main reasons. While they all enable you to focus more deeply, they also safeguard your mind from wandering in the first place. Later in the book, we'll examine a few other factors that lead your mind to wander, including how tired you are and how happy you feel. Your happiness level can impact your attention in many curious ways. For now, though, let's dive deeper into the mind-wandering factor I personally find most interesting: the attentional space we have to spare. The power of making your work harder. Depending on their complexity, tasks will require varying amounts of your attentional space. If you've ever tried to meditate and focus only on your breath for a few minutes, you might have noticed your mind wanders more than usual, far more than when you're going for a run, carrying on a deep conversation, or watching a movie. These latter tasks are more complex and fill more of your attentional space by default. As a footnote, the power of meditation is that reining your mind to focus on a small and simple object of attention makes focusing on more complex things easier. As a result, your mind wanders less, you're able to focus more deeply and for longer periods, and the quality of your attention increases dramatically. Meditation practices are less intimidating than you may think and are worth trying. Consciously making your tasks more complex and taking on more complex ones is another powerful way to enter into a hyper-focused state, as they will consume more of your attention. This will keep you more engaged in what you're doing and lead your mind to wander less often. In his groundbreaking book, Flow, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi offers interesting insights about when we're most likely to enter into a flow state: when the challenge of completing a task is roughly equal to our ability to do so, and we become totally immersed in the task. When our skills greatly exceed the demands of a task, such as when we do mindless data entry for several hours, we feel bored. When the demands of a task exceed our skills, such as when we're unprepared to give a presentation, we feel anxious. When the demands of a task are roughly equal to our ability to do that task, when we're playing an instrument, immersed in a book, or skiing down a freshly powdered slope, we're a lot more likely to be fully engaged in what we're doing. If you find it difficult to become immersed in your work throughout the day, it's worth questioning whether your tasks are difficult and complex enough. If you're frequently bored, consider whether your job takes advantage of your unique skill set. If your mind is frequently wandering, even after implementing the ideas in the previous chapters, it's a pretty good sign your tasks aren't complex enough and don't consume enough of your attentional space. The larger your attentional space, the more your mind wanders when you work on something simple. This is further evidence that the smartest members of your team should be assigned the most challenging work. On the opposite end of the spectrum, if you find you're anxious at work, even after taming distractions and working with more intention, consider whether your current skills are a good match for the tasks at hand. Outside of questioning individual tasks, it's also worth reflecting on how challenging you find your workload in general. The tactics in hyperfocus will allow you to accomplish more in less time, but you may then find you don't have enough work remaining to fill that extra time. This can manifest itself in some odd ways. Our work tends to expand to fit the available completion time. In productivity circles, this phenomenon is known as Parkinson's Law. But by disabling distractions in advance, you may find the same thing I did. Your work no longer expands to fit the time you have available for its completion, and you discover how much work you truly have on your plate. Some executives I coach find they're able to accomplish a full day's work in just a few hours when they focus on only their most consequential tasks. I discovered this phenomenon firsthand with my last book. After handing in the 80,000-word manuscript, which I wrote in a relatively short amount of time, I continued to be just as busy, even though I had substantially less work. My remaining projects expanded to fit the time I had available. Instead of planning for speaking engagements a few weeks before they were scheduled, I began to think about them much further in advance, much earlier than I needed to. I logged into my social media accounts more often when I should have been working. I stopped following my own advice and checked for new emails constantly instead of once a day. I enabled more notifications and alerts so I would have more tasks to tend to. And I agreed to more meetings, many of which I didn't need to attend in the first place. I experienced a dreaded feeling of guilt whenever I wasn't busy, which, of course, disappeared as soon as I did more busy work. Little did I know that this guilt had two sources: a lack of working with intent, and my work expanding to fill how much time I had for it. It took several months before I finally stepped back to tame the novel distractions that were flooding my available time. In doing so, I discovered how little work I actually had on my plate. In response, I intentionally took on more meaningful tasks, writing more for my website, thinking about this book, and ramping up my speaking and coaching sessions. Because I think of myself as a pretty productive guy, my failure was tough to admit to myself, but it taught me an essential lesson. Doing mindless stuff at work or at home is not only unproductive, but also a sign you don't have enough important work. This also accounts for why busy work gets set aside when you're on deadline. There's no time available to contain its expansion. To measure if you have enough work in general, assess how much of your day you spend doing unproductive busy work. If you're high on the busy work scale, you may have room to take on significantly more tasks and become more engaged and productive in the process. This advice is counterintuitive, and the very idea may turn you off if you already feel you're working at capacity. But it's worth considering. When we do knowledge work for a living, we procrastinate, spending time and attention on email and social media, tasks that make us feel productive in our work, but lead us to accomplish little. A side note on rote tasks. While rote work is often less productive than complex tasks, it is redeeming in one way. It's usually more fun. Studies show we prefer mundane tasks like data entry over more complex tasks like writing reports. In writing this book, I visited Microsoft's research department, which conducts many studies on how we manage our attention. On each of my three trips there, the staff was adamant in confirming that we're happier doing tasks that don't consume our complete attention. This makes sense. While our productive tasks are important, they're usually also more aversive, which is why we're usually well compensated to do them. They take advantage of our unique mental resources. At the same time, mindless work can give us immediate feedback and the sense of having accomplished something. If certain rote tasks bring you genuine enjoyment, don't let a productivity book make you stop doing them, but do eliminate some to carve out more time and attention for significant tasks. Increasing the size of your attentional space. Most of the focus strategies I've discussed so far involve becoming a better custodian of your attentional space. In addition to more deliberately managing it, you can also increase its size. To recap, the size of attentional space is determined by a measure that cognitive psychology refers to as working memory capacity, how many pieces of data you can hold in your mind simultaneously, usually about 4 chunks of information. The greater your working memory capacity, the more information you can hold at the same time, and the greater your ability to process complex tasks. As well as allowing you to take on more complex tasks, expanding your attentional space offers other benefits. A higher working memory capacity has been shown to reduce mind wandering when you're focused on complex tasks. When your mind does wander, it actually wanders more productively. The larger the size of your attentional space, the more likely you are to think about and plan for the future. Even better, a larger attentional space means you'll have extra attention to think about what you'll work on next while keeping your original intention in mind. A larger attentional space also helps you get back on track quicker after your mind wanders or you become distracted. One study expressed this memorably when it stated that possessing a greater working memory capacity, quote, enables you to take full advantage of these underutilized resources and return to your favored mental destination. So how do you expand the size of your attentional space? There are many brain training apps and websites that promise to build memory and attention. Simply put, most of their claims are dubious. In laboratory studies, they simply don't hold water. While a few brain training apps work in the short term and help you remember a bit more and problem solve a bit better, their impact ends there. You have to stick with them for several hours a week in order for them to continue working, and as soon as you stop, you lose the gains you've made. One study measured the effectiveness of these programs across a sample size of 11,430 participants. It found, quote, no evidence, end quote, that the apps worked, even when the tasks they measured were the ones they were designed to improve. There is, however, one practice that has been proven in study after study to increase working memory capacity. Meditation. Meditation gets a bad rap and often conjures images of a monk meditating in a cave. In practice, it's actually quite simple. Like hyperfocus, meditation involves continually returning your focus to a single object of attention, usually your breath, as soon as you notice your mind has wandered from it. In breathing meditation, the most common form and the one I've personally practiced for about a decade, you notice the characteristics of your breath, how deeply it ebbs and flows, its temperature, where it is most prominent on your body, how your in-breath transitions to your out-breath, and so on. Since observing your breath doesn't consume your full attention, your mind will wander constantly, which is somewhat the point. Each time you return your wandering mind to the details of your breath, you heighten your executive functioning, how much control you have over your attention. This eventually enables you to improve each measure of the quality of your attention. You'll be able to focus for longer, your mind will wander less, and you'll be able to work with greater intention. You experience this same benefit during hyperfocus. Like meditation, hyperfocus is a practice that compounds upon itself. The more you practice, the more you learn to manage your attention, and the longer you're able to focus the next time around. Meditation is simple. Sit somewhere with your eyes closed and pay attention to your breath. It's natural to feel as if you're doing it wrong, especially at first, but don't overthink it. The effects of this simple practice are actually profound. One study discovered that when participants developed a meditation practice, not only did their minds wander less, but they could also focus for longer before that happened, two measures of the quality of attention. This study introduced meditation to students studying for the GRE, a standardized graduate admissions test in the United States. When it came time for them to take the test, their scores rose an average of 16%. Meditation has also been shown to prevent, quote, the deterioration of working memory capacity during periods of high stress, end quote, such as working in a chaotic environment or dealing with personal concerns. One review of the literature on the subject described meditation's benefits most succinctly, calling it, quote, the most validated technique for minimizing the disruptive effects of mind wandering, end quote. My favorite study of meditation measured how participants' working memory capacity increased when they had an active meditation practice. The researchers guided participants through a 45-minute meditation exercise twice a week and encouraged them to meditate at home. A few weeks later, they discovered something incredible in the working memory capacity of everyone who meditated. It increased by an average of more than 30%. That was significantly more than that of two other groups of subjects in the study, one of which practiced yoga for several weeks. This effect was also observed after a period of just a few weeks. To begin meditating requires just a few minutes every day. Start by determining your resistance level, as you do before hyper-focusing on a task. Then, sit in a chair, in a comfortable but upright posture, so the discs of your spine are stacked one on top of another. Notice the qualities of your breath and refocus on them whenever your mind wanders. I highly recommend using an app to get started. I like Headspace and Insight Timer, which both feature guided meditations to help you get started. Approach each meditation session with a genuine curiosity about where your mind will wander. My meditation rule is simple, and one I've stuck with for years. It doesn't matter how long I meditate, as long as I do so each day. Some days, I can spare only a minute or two, which is sufficient as long as I keep faithful to a routine. When I began a decade ago, I did only 5-minute sessions, and since then has slowly built to 30 minutes. I wouldn't give it up for anything. When you practice being with your breath, you practice being with your life. But meditation is not the only tool in this toolkit. Practicing mindfulness is another proven way to increase the size of your attentional space. It's similar to meditation, but a little less intimidating. Mindfulness is about becoming conscious of what is filling your mind and noticing the circumstances of the current moment. This includes noting anything you happen to be perceiving, feeling, or thinking. Mindfulness differs from hyperfocus in one major respect. It's about focusing on the circumstances of the present rather than becoming immersed in them. Here's a statement that might sound strange. You've never really taken a shower. While you might stand there while the water washes over you, your mind is usually elsewhere, at the office, running through your daily checklist, thinking about what you need to buy for dinner, or brainstorming about a problem you're facing at work. While a small part of it runs through the habit sequence of taking a shower, your mind isn't with you, present with what you're experiencing. A mindful shower is one in which you focus on the sights, sounds, and sensations of the present, which enables you to train your brain to better focus on what's in front of you. Begin to practice mindfulness by choosing one daily task that doesn't consume your complete attention, sipping your morning coffee, walking through the office or taking a shower, and intentionally be with that experience for a minute or two. Anchor your attention to the circumstances of the present moment. Notice the smell, taste, and feeling of a cup of coffee. The momentum shifts in your body as you walk from one room in the office to another, or the temperature and sensations of taking a shower. You can set a timer or not. Simply be with the circumstances of the present moment and notice as much as you can about what you're seeing, hearing, and feeling. When you find yourself becoming lost in thought, bring your mind back to what you originally intended to focus on and laugh at how difficult it can be to tame. Don't be too hard on yourself when your mind wanders. Remember, your brain was built to do this. Here's the key. The smaller the object of attention, the more your mind will wander, but the more you'll expand the size of your attentional space as you focus on it. The more quickly you're able to get back on track after your mind ventures off during a mindfulness or meditation session, the better you'll become at focusing at work and at home. Practices like meditation and mindfulness are also powerful because they train you to practice holding a single intention in your mind for a given period of time. During your meditation, you sit with the intention of being with your breath until your timer goes off. The same is true when you practice mindfulness. until the cup of coffee is empty or half full, your shower is finished, or you're done walking to where you intend to go. You focus on what you're doing then and there. When you keep a single intention in mind, you're able to live and work more intentionally for the rest of the day too. And because both meditation and mindfulness increase the size of your attentional space, both practices make you more likely to maintain intentions. As if these benefits weren't enough, meditation and mindfulness also help you step back from your thoughts. This makes it infinitely easier to check what's occupying your attentional space. The more you notice what's grasped your attention, the more quickly you'll be able to redirect it to your intention. With enough awareness, you might even notice your mind has wandered to somewhere productive, and you want to continue that train of thought. For example, a higher working memory capacity means your mind is more likely to make plans and set intentions for the future. With this extra awareness, you gain the power to notice stray objects of attention at the edges of your attentional space, such as when you're seeking external stimulation or about to fall victim to a seductive distraction. The research is clear. Mindfulness and meditation improve virtually every aspect of how you manage your attention. Every once in a while, I like to travel to a local Buddhist monastery to join a public Saturday afternoon meditation. This usually consists of a potluck and an hour-long meditation session, followed by a talk given by one of the monks. During one of my visits, a monk spoke about how for several weeks during his meditation practice, he focused solely on the sensation his breath made on the tip of his nose, an impossibly small object of attention. I tried doing the same during an extended 2-hour meditation practice the next day, and my mind has never wandered so much. With an object of attention that small, it's no surprise. But the following Monday morning, I focused more deeply on my work than I had in weeks. I wrote several thousand words in just a few hours, brainstormed 3 talks, and had time left over to clear my email inboxes. The positive effects lingered beyond that day, as I was able to better focus throughout the week. The quality of attention is so integral to productivity that increasing it, even slightly, makes a remarkable difference in how much we accomplish. Luckily, you don't have to spend hours focusing on the tip of your nose to experience the remarkable benefits of mindfulness and meditation. Even only a few minutes a day will help immensely. If you take away one lesson from this chapter, it should be that few practices will improve the quality of your attention and the size of your attentional space more than meditation and mindfulness. While both will consume some of your time, you'll make that time back and then some in how much more clearly, deeply, and deliberately you'll think and focus. Hyperfocus at home. Almost every idea in this book will help you not only at work, but at home too. As I've put these ideas into practice, I've noticed some remarkable benefits in my personal life. Chances are you were in hyperfocus mode during your last highly productive work period. You were likely in a similar state the last time you felt happiest and energized at home. You were probably focused on just one thing. Whether that was carrying on a meaningful conversation with a loved one, planting a garden, playing cards with a relative, or relaxing with a book on the beach. The one thing you were doing consumed your full attentional space. Because of this, you likely didn't have many surrounding distractions. Your work phone may have been in the other room, and you may have had a commitment to disconnect for the weekend. Your family may have agreed to a phone-free dinner. You're probably also in a more relaxed state, and, because of this, didn't seek novel stimuli in your environment. You could focus with relative ease on what you were doing. Hyperfocus was the best term I could come up with to describe this state of being totally focused on one thing, though it does have the disadvantage of sounding dauntingly intense. In practice, hyperfocus is actually quite relaxed, unless you're on a deadline or are working at or above capacity, so your work doesn't have the luxury of expanding to fit an amount of time. When you hyperfocus, you're surrounded by very few novel objects of attention, and what you're doing fills your attentional space quite naturally. This same idea holds true at home, and we experience the same benefits of hyperfocus there. We remember more of what we're doing, and our experiences become more meaningful as a result. We spend more time in the moment and get things done more quickly and with less effort. I like to do this by setting 3 personal intentions in addition to my 3 work goals, even if one happens to be binge-watching a show on Netflix. One area I've noticed that particularly benefits from hyperfocus is conversations. The secret to deep, meaningful conversations is simple. Bring your complete attention to the person you're speaking with. You can do this in many ways, such as by allowing someone to finish talking before you start, a simple but highly underutilized technique. Wait until you hear the period at the end of their sentence before you think about what you'll say next. I'm convinced that most people have a sixth sense and can tell when you're truly paying attention to them. It's a remarkable thing when you spend not just quality time with someone, but quality attention as well. Hyperfocus lets me dive deeper into my personal relationships, in conversation and other aspects. I'm convinced that love is nothing more than sharing quality attention with someone. As David Osberger, a Baptist minister and author, has put it, quote, "Being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person, they are almost indistinguishable." When we're hyper-focusing on an activity at home, whether it's playing an instrument, walking the dog, or making dinner for the family, disabling the pointless novel distractions and focusing completely on what we're doing means we are purposefully disengaging from our work. This practice gets easier with time. I've devoted an entire later chapter of this audiobook to recharging hyperfocus. We can do this by periodically stepping back from our work to let our mind rest, wander, and take on less challenging tasks. Spending our time at home more purposefully also enables us to feel recharged. Whether at work or at home, the quality of your attention determines the quality of your life. At work, the more attention you give to what's in front of you, the more productive you become. At home, the more attention you devote to what's in front of you, the more meaningful your life becomes. 4 more ways to battle your resistance to hyperfocus. This chapter covers a number of tactics that will help you develop an even stronger hyperfocus habit. Making your work more challenging, taking on more projects at work and at home, increasing the size of your attentional space, practicing hyperfocus in all areas of life, and choosing exactly when to hyperfocus. Let's end with one final important concept that will help you to solidify a hyperfocus ritual in your work and life: how to battle your inevitable resistance to the mode. Assuming you've already given hyperfocus a try, even if only for 10 minutes, you may have felt what I did at first: a mental resistance to focusing on just one thing. This was probably a mixture of restlessness, anxiousness, and succumbing to novel distractions. You likely found yourself craving those distractions more than usual in the initial stage of entering the hyperfocused state. This resistance we feel toward complex and productive tasks isn't distributed evenly across working time. It's usually concentrated at the beginning of when we start these tasks. For example, while it might take weeks to summon the energy and the stamina needed to clean the garage or bedroom closet, once we do it for even just a minute, we could keep going for hours. The same is true for working out. After we overcome our resistance to getting started, we can go on with the rest of our workout. Starting provides enough momentum to carry out our intentions. This is true of our most complex tasks as well, and is one of the many reasons we'll work on a task for only 40 seconds before falling victim to distractions. We feel the most resistance at the very start and search instead for more attractive alternatives. When we begin a new task, working on it for at least 1 minute with purposeful attention and limited distractions is critical. Here are my 4 favorite strategies for battling this initial resistance. 1. Shrink your desired hyperfocus period until you no longer feel resistance to the ritual. Minimize the amount of time you'll dedicate to focusing on one task until you no longer feel mental resistance to it. Even setting a mental deadline of 5 minutes will likely be enough to get you started. 2. Notice when you don't have time for something. You always have time, you just spend it on other things. When you find yourself saying this familiar statement, try doing a task swap. For example, if you don't have the time to catch up with a friend over coffee, ask yourself whether you'd have an equal amount of time to watch the football game or surf Facebook. If you feel you don't have time to take something on, ask yourself whether you could free up your schedule enough to meet with your boss or clean your inbox. If the task swap shows you do have the time, chances are this is just your resistance talking. 3. Continually practice hyperfocus. Incorporate at least 1 hyperfocus interval each day. You'll experience less resistance as you get accustomed to working with fewer distractions and appreciate how productive you've become. 4. Recharge. Hyperfocus can be oddly energizing. You spend less energy regulating your behavior when you don't have to continually resist distractions and push yourself to focus on what's important. That said, resisting the ritual can also be a sign you need to recharge. The power of hyperfocus. Every idea in hyperfocus is designed to help you more deliberately manage your attention. An essential idea when our attention is so limited and in demand. Let's recap a few of these ideas. Understanding the 4 types of productive and unproductive work tasks lets us step back and figure out what's actually important so we can stop working on mindless autopilot mode. Recognizing the limits of our attention enables us to become aware of how few things we're able to focus on in the moment. Hyperfocusing on our most complex, productive tasks lets us activate the most productive mode of our brains and get a large amount accomplished in a short amount of time. Setting strong daily intentions lets us work on our most productive tasks. Creating a personalized distraction-free mode and a reduced distractions mode lets us work with more focus and clarity while directing our time and attention away from needless distractions. Simplifying our working and living environments lets us think more clearly by taking stock of the distractions that surround us. Clearing our minds using waiting for, task, and worry lists lets us work with clarity and prevents unresolved mental loops from interrupting our focus throughout the day. Becoming good custodians of our attentional space by making our work more complex when necessary and by expanding the limits of our attention helps us properly manage our limited attention. In the beginning of this audiobook, you may recall that I made a few lofty claims about how transformative it can be to purposefully manage your attention. If you've acted upon the advice so far, I think you'll find what I did, that your work and your life have been positively changed as a result of this practice. As you've acted upon the advice in the first 5 chapters, I hope you've already become more productive, more engaged with your work and life, and a clearer and calmer thinker. You probably also remember more and view your work and life as more meaningful. All 3 measures of the quality of your attention have also likely increased. You spend more of your time deliberately, you are able to focus longer in one sitting, and your mind doesn't wander from your intentions nearly as much. There is a wealth of research on how we can best focus, and in the first 5 chapters, I've done my best to summarize it in a way that is both practical and tactical. I hope you'll agree. Attention is the most important ingredient we have to living a good, productive life. The power of mind wandering. To this point in the audiobook, I've discussed only the negative effects of a wandering mind. At times when we need to focus, these mental strolls